If you understand your risks as a practice, lean into them. And by that, I mean, look for solutions and actions and things to do to help mitigate it. Those are there.
Welcome to Off the Chart, a Business of Medicine podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors and medical practices. I'm your host, Keith Reynolds, and this week we've got a conversation between Medical Economics Managing Editor Todd Shryock and Peter Riley, North American Healthcare Practice Leader and Chief Sales Officer at Hub International. They'll be talking about the risks medical practices face in 2025, and we'll offer up some advice for practice managers looking to stay prepared.
I'm here today with Pete Riley, practice leader at Hub International, to talk about risk management looking into 2025. Pete, thanks for joining me.
Happy to do it, Todd. Glad to be here.
So, Pete, you guys have a new report out, the 2025 U.S. Healthcare Outlook, Risk Management and Economic Viability. And reading through it, it seems like if you're in healthcare, you might want to hide behind the couch until 2026. I mean, there's a lot of things to think about coming into the new year.
It is indeed, Todd, and the like many industries, 2024, 2025 is going to be interesting for a number of reasons. Not sure I'd want to say you have to hide behind the couch, but I certainly take your meaning that it is a challenging time. But I think what we at Hub in particular are trying to do is to say, if you have an understanding of some of the risks and the dynamic challenges that are going to be there, and there is a process to plan and prepare for it, I hope it's not lost in that the various outlook reports we have, the resiliency that can be there for a healthcare institution will allow you to continue through, but I'm not sure 2026 is going to be an easier year per se. But it's a very challenging time in the healthcare industry as a whole for a number of reasons.
One of the things the report touches on is something I think everybody is well aware of in healthcare is costs keep going up, reimbursements keep going down. You know, what's driving this? Do you expect this trend to continue through 2025?
Well, the answer to the latter part of your question is, do we expect it to continue based on what we know now? The answer is yes. The costs are increasing for a whole myriad of reasons. Increased, inflationary pressures on so much that impacts the human people's households also impacts organizations and healthcare. So the cost of doing business has gone up from wages for the not only clinical staff, but also the folks in the various facilities. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We want to pay these individuals who work in healthcare, a good wage, because we have a very robust and good healthcare system, but we want to continue to keep it that way. And you want it to be a viable career. But that increased labor cost puts additional pressures on so many other things within the care delivery organization that they have to essentially shoulder those burdens. There's also increased use of medications and pharmacy drugs, which are expensive. The GLP-1s and the costs that have gone there, that gets right back to not only the provider, but the consumers. And there's really a increased usage by an elderly population that it does cost more to treat people whose bodies are breaking down, be it through surgeries or just general illness. So all of those factors will continue. We are, in some respects, victims of our own success in terms of extending the lifespan of most people. The reimbursement side is always a challenge because whether it be CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, or private health insurance providers, they are trying to control costs that they then have to pass back onto the consumer in terms of premiums or tax bills, depending on where you are. And so they are really trying to hold down their reimbursement levels for, again, ideally the right reasons, but it puts sort of the vicious cycle back into continued financial pressures on the providers themselves or their organizations, and the need to increase costs to, you know, almost run in place. There are a number of very good articles that have been published in a number of fantastic journals like yours and others that speak to this dynamic push-pull. I mean, it's very much a market-driven dynamic. But at a macro sense, yes, we expect this to continue because wages, while slowing a bit, continue to rise. And then the inflationary pressures that we see both in the U.S. and Canada persist. And so that's going to make the payors want to continue to keep their reimbursements down so they don't continue this sort of never-ending vicious cycle.
Costs have really hit rural hospitals hard.
Oh, yes.
Based on the recent struggles of rural hospitals, should physicians at these facilities or physicians that do business with them be worried about their future?
Sadly, the answer is both yes and no. Yes, too many rural hospitals, critical access hospitals, the smaller community hospitals, you know, have closed in really the past decade. And to our discussion on your prior question, the financial pressures that these institutions face continue to really create a strain for them to continue to deliver the level of care that they have. That is going to persist. And physicians who work in these or work with these facilities should ask some tough questions so that they can protect themselves. I think the side where I wouldn't be as concerned is I think America is certainly waking up to the reality that when you close a number of these smaller hospitals, these rural hospitals, you take out not only a good employer base for those localities, but you really create almost healthcare deserts in many parts of the U.S. where people simply don't get the healthcare they need. And so I think there's a gradual awakening, and a credit to a number of lobbying organizations that are saying that is really unhealthy in a particularly post-pandemic America where a lot of people moved out to these more rural locations. The ripples that it will now have, I think, go much farther than what they did previously. And so there is some awareness at state and local levels for the need to help protect these institutions. And while that's still a newer trend, if it continues, as I hope it will and think it will, I think the fear that these hospitals might close will be lessened. But at the moment, I think it is appropriate for practitioners to ask questions, know the financial health, and ask what are the plans to deal with it. Because these communities desperately need these institutions, need those providers, but you have to do it with eyes wide open.
The report also points out that the worker shortage and the burnout that comes with it aren't going away anytime soon. Is there anything a physician practice owner can do to help mitigate the mental strain for his or her employees to increase retention?
Yeah, Todd, this is probably, in my opinion, the single biggest sort of silent killer, if you will, to healthcare delivery for physicians' offices. Healthcare delivery is not a rational business sometimes from the patient perspective. We want to be cured. And so the pressure is always on the workforce at, be it a doctor, be it a receptionist at the front desk. It is an intense environment in which to work. And I do think this is going to continue because it is as much a calling as a career for many people, even those folks at the front desk. So it is going to continue to be a pressure and a burnout situation. There are really a number of ways that the practices, I think, can help alleviate some of that. We could do an entirely separate article on this, but there a number of enhanced employee benefits that don't necessarily cost too much. Enhanced child care strategies that maybe a community, particularly as we talked a little earlier about rural hospitals, can coordinate across certain communities. There are a number of flexible workforce, flexible timing, the number of days that you can three on, or sorry, say four on and three off, types of pieces. But the best advice I can give in answer to that is talk to someone within that firm that provides a number of your employee benefits, because there are a number of underutilized tools that are there. And if nothing else, providing some access to, I'll call it wellness counseling. There are a number of services, not so much the, you know, the services that people have always had for, you know, those who face addiction or other issues, but simply a platform where workers can talk about this in a very safe and welcoming environment will, and there's enough evidence in the psychiatric community to say that, you know, when they talk about this and they can grapple with it openly rather than hide behind the burnout and the psychological challenges, it does make a difference. And a lot of those can be done, those types of platforms can be done virtually, you know, telehealth type of arrangements, and they can be very cost effective. But that is going to continue to be, and it's going to vary by location. So there is no one size fits all answer there. But the first and I think best place to ask is go to an employee benefits broker who handles the traditional physical health side of the house and ask about the tools and resources that are now available for, you know, employee resiliency. And there are a number of, I keep calling them tools, but they're strategies and other approaches that are now beginning to take hold, and some with real success.
Say, Keith, this is all well and good, but what if someone is looking for more clinical information?
Oh, then they want to check out our sister site, patientcareonline.com, the leading clinical resource for primary care physicians. Again, that's patientcareonline.com.
We can't talk about risk management physicians without talking about malpractice. So what's happening in the medical professional liability markets, and how do you see that playing out for rates in 2025?
Well, the MPL marketplace, medical professional liability marketplace, continues to underwrite at a loss, meaning for every dollar they take in, the larger industry is paying out more. And so that continues to put financial pressures on the insurance carriers and thus pass on premium costs to the providers. There are certain pockets in the country that are now seeing a great deal of more an effective competition or sort of rate, I wouldn't call them decreases, but stabilization. Some will see decreases with outstanding losses, but at least we're beginning to see some more stabilization in a number of places. There are a handful of jurisdictions, New Mexico, Georgia, Montana, a surprise sort of participant in that list, that have come about in addition to the traditional really challenging environments of Cook County, Philadelphia County, the five boroughs of New York, those things. So the market continues to be a real challenge for both buyer and carrier. I don't believe the answer is always just to go market and to try to find just a lower premium. This is really a process-driven decision on the part of underwriters, and I think buyers need to become more actively involved, understand where their losses are coming from, because that's what's driving so much of this. Frequency continues to be stable or down, but severity is up. So why is that happening? And really understanding those cost drivers and taking mitigation steps to really try to attack those root causes, that will bring better long-term success in lowering rates than just going out to market every single year and seeking the lowest premium. But I would also encourage doctors to talk with the underwriters and explain to them firsthand, rate fatigue is real and I simply cannot continue at this pace. I need help. You know, there's a lot of talk of partnerships from underwriters and carriers, as there should be. So it's okay to ask that, hey, I can't take a double-digit increase this year. I can only take X. Otherwise, you impact my quality of care, which ultimately hurts them. A very frank dialogue is not only warranted and appropriate, but I think necessary, because unfortunate losses from certain markets have impacted most of the community. And that degree of dialogue between the insured and the insurer needs to take place. That is having reaping better results from what we are seeing than just trying to take a shotgun approach to the marketplace. But overall, it's still tough. It may be getting a little better, again, in the macro sense, but we're probably still at least a year or two away from really being able to potentially see a broader rate reduction environment.
We're seeing a lot more natural disasters that can take a practice offline for weeks or even months. What can a practice owner do to mitigate the risk those types of events pose?
There's really two, I think, very important pieces, Todd, that the practices need to undertake. They need to have a very frank conversation about where they're located. What is their exposure to climate-related risks? We've always focused very heavily on, you know, hurricane and, you know, catastrophic weather locations, Florida or the wildfires of California. But even now, where you see severe cold, which is currently taking place in certain parts of the U.S., practitioners need to take a very clear-eyed view of what are their, you know, weather or climate risks, determine what they are. Maybe it's just a potential of a frozen pipe. But if you look at what happens, you know, in Western North Carolina, I don't think anybody in their fair reflection would say, yes, this is what we thought was going to happen. And so that's number one, is to have a very frank view of what are your exposures. And then number two, and this is really one that I think the medical community does not always take advantage of, is every single property insurer and even many other insurance carriers want to help prepare their clients to mitigate their exposure to risk. Go ask about these resources. They are there. If you are in a flood-prone area, what are some basic steps that can be done? One, for, you know, life safety first and foremost, but then are there simple things that can be done in order to minimize the amount of time in which you are out of operation? Are you properly insured for what that business interruption or extra expense might be? But really tapping into those carrier resources, usually your property insurer, that'll have a number of guides, ideas, resources to help mitigate. And then if there's a third piece, and this one historically was a post-disaster problem, but putting together a disaster recovery plan is in order anymore, simply because we're seeing it happen so much more. This isn't, or doesn't necessarily need to be a, you know, voluminous document, but simply it's a checklist at a minimum to make sure you're addressing the things that which you can mitigate, you do. Because when the disaster hits, often and for obvious reasons, your mind is on just self-preservation for the individual, your staff, their families, et cetera, et cetera. So as a part of utilizing the resources available, putting together at least the beginnings of a disaster recovery plan that can then be utilized and making it meaningful, I think is warranted, because unfortunately, I think there's most parts of the country. Vermont just a couple of years ago had horrific flooding there that really shut entire communities. You know, and there's almost no part of the country. The extreme heat in the Southwest even was closing some offices. And so knowing how to respond, you know, planning for it before it happens is going to be vital. But utilizing the resources you have to help you do that, and even some instances, maybe even give you a turnkey options, will help address that and will pay dividends, because this is a huge exposure to the risk management in the insurance industry, and people want to help.
Oh, you say you're a practice leader or administrator? We've got just the thing. Our sister site, physicianspractice.com, your one-stop shop for all the expert tips and tricks that will get your practice really humming. Again, that's physicianspractice.com.
The report also notes that healthcare continues to be a major target for cyber criminals, and I think everyone's aware of the Change Healthcare cyber attack and how it affected the entire healthcare system. How can practices manage the risk, not just to their own facility, but also the risk posed by vendors they might rely on to do business?
Well, in the heart of your question, Todd, I think is one of the vital pieces that is overlooked, and that is the interconnectivity of systems. Certainly, medical practices or facilities that do all the right things of keeping the patches up to date on their various programs and, you know, having firewalls and security pieces. You know, that's all well and good, and that needs to continue. And there should be continuous training for the front line, because, you know, people are the best defense to prevent, you know, cyber crime from really impacting you. But an understanding of the interconnectivity and change is the perfect example of how another network could really bring yours down. And speaking to any of your vendors, your contracts, or anyone you were working with where you have that cyber connectivity, understanding their defenses. And it's a step that probably 5 years ago, people didn't even think about taking, at least the general medical practice. Contractually, if those that interconnectivity becomes a problem, you should be reimbursed by them. You should have adequate, you know, contractual protections to go through that. And as we spoke a moment ago about sort of a climate disaster recovery plan, the same should really be there for a data security plan. And if all else fails, and I'm not advocating at all that people go back to paper medical records, but there should always be, and this is risk management 101 or 102, almost a backup and duplication of a vast majority of the of your records, because as the owner, the covered entity under HIPAA and other regulations, you need to take proactive steps so that you can secure your data for your own patient population. Cyber criminals know healthcare is one of the, you know, sort of perfect, you know, 5 points in the road where you have PHI, personal health information, PII, the personal identifiable information, all the financial data that comes with it. And I had to make a medical appointment just today and had to give out my birthday, confirm my address. And so you are giving away much of that PII that cyber criminals can use. But it's also back to some basic 101. And that's, as I mentioned, some of the training of don't click on links. If the staff doesn't understand an email or doesn't get it, pick up the phone. Talking to an individual often works better. But we do not see cyber criminals making any less effort to come after healthcare. And to think that just because you have either embedded insurance and perhaps your, you know, medical malpractice policy, or you may buy $1 million of coverage in a standalone cyber policy, that is not enough. There are a number of, let's say, proactive steps that have to be taken. And what we're also seeing is the plaintiff's bar, the act that if you don't take those proactive steps, they will come after you for any one of a number of other allegations. So I think cyber is now or should I say data security is a very well-known risk anymore. I still worry that too many providers, particularly physician practices, don't take it seriously enough. They will think, I don't own the records. It's off in the cloud with whomever. Talk to a lawyer and let them answer that for you, because you may not like the answer your insurance broker gives, but that's often the case. It's theirs and they need to protect it as if it was their own, you know, wallet.
Assuming we haven't scared everyone off by now, is there anything else risk management wise physicians need to be thinking about going into 2025?
Yeah. And Todd, it's hard because we don't want to give the impression that we're trying to scare them off. Every one of these issues, and it is a scary world when you think about all that could go wrong. But as I mentioned, there are so many resources available to medical practices and practitioners that can help mitigate that. And oftentimes they are either paid for in the premiums, or you work with a broker or a consultant or other intermediary who can help address these steps or these risks rather. And so what I would say that practitioners need to know, or at least take some time, is just as they sit down to do the planning with patients and their charts and look at the financials, any efforts taken to understand the risks that are faced. And in our outlook, we talk about leaning into it. It's a little bit like having, you know, wellness for illness prevention. If you understand what the illness can be and lean into behaviors and actions and things that you can do to mitigate, you know, don't smoke. One of the best ways not to get or prevent lung cancer. If you understand your risks as a practice, lean into them. And by that, I mean, you know, look for solutions and actions and things to do to help mitigate it. Those are there. And there's a very robust community that can help. And so leaning into that as a practice to understand it will allow for. And while all this is scary, it's mostly scary when you don't understand it. Once you do, you know, short of a natural disaster, which we can't control, so many of the other things are at least knowable. And just like the practice of medicine and the treatment of a disease, there is a process by which you can address them. And then certainly, and they sleep more soundly knowing that your practice is unlikely to be, to have a, you know, absolutely calamitous outcome in the event of a risk coming to fruition.
Pete, you've given us a lot of good stuff to think about going into the new year. As always, thanks for joining me.
Todd, always my pleasure. And I still remain very bullish on healthcare in America. We have fantastic practitioners, and I hope they will reach out for the resources, not just my organization, but there's hundreds of them in their associations and publications like yours to educate them. I think there's brighter days ahead, despite what we may seem to scare them. And I apologize for that.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank you, Todd.
Again, that was Medical Economics Managing Editor Todd Tryoch and Peter Riley, North American Healthcare Practice Leader and Chief Sales Officer at Hub International. My name is Keith Reynolds, and on behalf of the whole Medical Economics and Physicians Practice teams, I'd like to thank you for listening and ask that you please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so you don't miss the next episode. Also, if you'd like the best stories Medical Economics and Physicians Practice publish delivered straight to your email every single day of the week, subscribe to our newsletters at medicaleconomics.com and physicianspractice.com. Off the Chart, a Business of Medicine podcast, is executive produced by Chris Mazzolini and produced by Keith Reynolds and Austin Luttrell. Medical Economics, Physicians Practice, and Patient Care Online are all members of the MJH Life Sciences family. Thank you.